All right, thanks, Brooke. So 45 minutes to get through 30 pages. We'll see how this goes. All right, so my name is Carrie. I'm a recovered alcoholic, and my home group is the New Horizons Group, beautiful Bend, Oregon, and I'm currently living in the disciplines of steps 10, 11, and 12, which brings me and us to these two chapters we're looking at tonight, Two Wives and Family Afterward, which for those of you who haven't been joining us in the past, I don't know how many weeks we've been doing this now, 10 weeks, 13 weeks, whatever. I have considered for myself these chapters, Two Wives, Working with Others, Employers, just a continuation of working with others. Because even if you don't have a, if you're not a wife, or if you're not a whatever, if you don't have a family, these are spiritual principles, right? And they can apply to whatever. And so the first thing that I'm going to point out is, so that I don't forget to, I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit to the end of the chapter that we're on. We're on page 108, if I remember right from last week, at the very beginning of Two Wives. And then I'm just going to skip to the very end of the chapter, and I'm going to just point something out. If you guys want to highlight this in your books, you feel free. And if you don't, then don't worry about it. But on the bottom of page 121, there's an asterisk, and it points out that, well, the Fellowship of Al-Anon Family Groups was formed about 13 years after the chapter was written, right? So now we have different, we have a lot of these principles that they're talking about when applied to the person they're talking about. Now they have a whole new fellowship, right? But it's saying, however, though it's entirely separate from Alcoholics Anonymous, it uses general principles of the AA program as a guide for husbands, wives, relatives, friends, and others. And for me, others could even be sponsees, right? The people that I'm helping are alcoholics. These are principles to help us deal with alcoholics, and others close to alcoholics. So for me, these principles are not just specifically, I don't have to have a wife to have, to understand this stuff for me. So at the very bottom of page 108, and a lot of people, we're going to start on husband number one. I've heard sometimes people call these alcoholics number one, two, three, and four. They're not alcoholic number one, two, three, and four. Husband number one is the non-alcoholic. So it's the heavy drinker that can be reconciled with the bottom of page 20 up into the top of page 21. That's what describes the heavy drinker, which is not an alcoholic. And so husband number one, or drinker number one, if you will, but not alcoholic number one, reads, your husband may be only a heavy drinker. That should, only a heavy drinker should give it away, but for some it doesn't. His drinking may be constant or may be heavy only in certain occasions. Perhaps he spends too much money for liquor. It may be slowing him up mentally and physically, but he doesn't see it. Sometimes it's a source of embarrassment for you and his friends. He is positive that he can handle his liquor, that it does not harm him. The drinking is necessary in his business. He would probably be insulted if he were called an alcoholic. This world is, this is my highlight, this world is filled with people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether. And I would say if only 10% of us, and depending on the statistics and the scientific discoveries or whatever, I've heard anywhere from 9% to 11.5%, but basically about 10% of our society are alcoholic, right? Have that physical allergy to alcohol, where once we start drinking, we get thirsty and not quenched. And then there's 90% of the rest of the world that some don't drink at all. Some are heavy drinkers, some are moderate drinkers, but they're not alcoholic. And that's what they're describing here. So number two, husband number two, your husband is showing a lack of control, right? And what is alcoholism? It's the inability to control our drinking. So that gives it away that we're talking about the real alcoholic. It says, for he's unable to stay on the water wagon even when he wants to, right? And that's a difference between the heavy drinker and the real alcoholic. Is the heavy drinker, he can go get wasted, but when he wants to not drink, he doesn't. And the real alcoholic can't stay on the water wagon even when he wants to. Another highlight in that paragraph, because I don't have time to read all of this 30 pages, is he's worried that at times and is becoming aware that he cannot drink like other people, right? An abnormal reaction to alcohol. He can't drink like other people. And then right before the paragraph ends, it says, these are the earmarks of a real alcoholic. So that is obviously gives it away as well. So husband number three, my highlight in husband number three is he admits he cannot drink like other people, right in the middle of the paragraph, first paragraph on page 110. And he desperately wants to stop, but cannot. So obviously that one's not too difficult to qualify your friend, spouse, husband, whatever, as an alcoholic. And then finally, number four, this is the one that basically he might as well have it tattooed on his forehead or wearing the t-shirt that says, I'm the real alcoholic. My highlight on this one is sometimes he drinks on the way home from the hospital. That's a pretty obvious sign. Perhaps he has had DTs. And then my last highlight, many of our husbands were just as far gone, yet they got well. That's hope. They got well. Top of page 111, paragraph two, never tell him what he must do about his drinking. Now this is talking about husband number two. If he gets the idea that you are a nag or a killjoy, your chances of accomplishing anything useful may be zero. And this is true for me with, you know, new alcoholics that I work with, new alcoholics that come to my home group. I've heard people in meetings say, you know, nobody makes it to AA on accident. And if you're in this room, you're probably an alcoholic. No, don't say that stuff. Oh, and you're in the right place. No, some of them aren't. Some of them just got a DUI because they went out celebrating. Like, don't brand anybody an alcoholic, right? The book tells us that over and over again. At the bottom of the page, it says, try to have him bring up the subject himself. So, and now I think we're on husband number three now, because it described husband number one, two, three, and four. And then it's describing how to deal with husbands number one, two, three, and four. So try to have him bring up the subject himself, right? Be sure you are not critical during a discussion. Attempt to instead to put yourself in his place. So it's saying don't come after him about his drinking. Let him bring up the subject himself. At the bottom of page 112, suppose, however, that your husband fits the description of number two. Oh, okay, so we're only on the description of number two. One should be, it's going back and forth. One should be practiced, but after his next drinking binge, after his next binge, ask him if he would really like to get over his drinking for good, right? Not just for today, not for one day at a time. Ask him if he wants to get over his drinking for good. Do not ask that he do it for you or anyone else. Just would he like to? And that's going to make all the difference, I'm sure, in his willingness. Top of page 113, if he's enthusiastic, your cooperation will mean a great deal. If he's lukewarm or thinks he's not an alcoholic, we suggest leave him alone. Avoid urging him to follow our program. And this goes for alcoholics who show up in the rooms of AA wanting me to sign their court slips. I am happy to sign their court slips. I am happy to not affiliate, but cooperate, right? I'm happy to get them a cup of coffee and to answer any questions they have about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I am not going to push them to follow a program if they're not alcoholic. The seed has been planted in his mind. He knows that myself have recovered. Okay, sorry about that. All right, so it's saying to not bring up the fact that there's thousands of alcoholics, much like himself, who have recovered. Don't bring that up when he's drunk, right? But wait until repeated stumbling convinces him that he must act. And this is what the book's been telling us all the way through, right? Alcohol is the great persuader. John Barleycorn can persuade us in ways that no human power can, right? King alcohol is the great persuader. For the more you hurry him, the longer his recovery may be delayed. Oh my gosh, my first couple of dozen sponsees, well, victims, let's be honest, I can't even believe how much I delayed their bottom in trying to convince them to, no, don't drink. Just call me if you want to drink. Don't do anything but drink. And I'd go to I'd go pick them up at the bars if they were calling me from the parking lot. And I needed every last drop to convince me, to give me a solid first step experience. And for me to take that away from someone else, to delay what they need in order to actually do the deal, is robbing someone of their own experience. And I don't do that anymore. So if you have a husband number three, this is on page 113, you may be in luck. Being certain he wants to stop, you can go with him. You can go to him with this volume, the big book, as joyfully as though you have struck oil. He may not share your enthusiasm, but he is practically sure to read this book, and he may go for the program at once. If he does not, you will probably not have to wait too long. Again, you should not crowd him. Let him decide for himself. Cheerfully see him through more sprees. Hey, how you feeling, honey? Wakey, wakey. Talk about his condition. Or this book only when he raises the issue. So again, wait for him to be in a place where he's in that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, right? So page 114, top of the page, sometimes there are cases where alcoholism is complicated by other disorders, outside issues. A good doctor or psychiatrist can tell you whether these complications are serious. Now, notice what it doesn't say. A good sponsor can tell you whether these complications are serious. I'm a good sponsor, and I have no business telling anybody that they need medication or that they need to come off of their medication. No business. I don't get a play doctor. But I can support my sponsee, or in this case, my husband, if you're reading it from, the wife's perspective, I can support them going into the doctor. I can support what the doctor is saying. I can go with them for support. But I don't get a play doctor. Page 115, bottom of the page, frequently you have felt obliged to tell your husband, to tell your husband's employer and friends that he was sick, when as a matter of fact, he was tight. And now we know that tight means drunk. I used to thought it meant cheap. Avoiding answering these inquiries as much as you can. Avoid answering these inquiries as much as you can wherever possible, whenever possible. Let your husband explain. Your desire to protect him should not cause you to lie to people when they have a right to know where he is and what he's doing. Discuss this with him when he's sober and in good spirits. Ask him what you should do if he places you in such a position again. Now, taking this back again to sponsorship, I don't know about you guys, but I have been in this position with a sponsee so many times, right? They all of a sudden go and get drunk or lose their sobriety date, and the home group starts asking, hey, where is Susie Joe? Or, hey, how is this person doing? And I'm going, uh-oh, what do I do, right? It's not my job. I can't say that she, like, anonymity. I'm not going to be gossiping. What do I do? Right. And so that's when I will, when this person, when I, the person that I'm working with, the still sick and suffering alcoholic, they get drunk, they call me, they let me know, oh my God, Carrie, I'm drunk. I can't believe I did this again. What do? I'm going to go into Sageview, or I'm going to check myself into detox or whatever. I actually ask them, hey, this is a great idea. I'm going to support you. Let's do this together, blah, blah, blah. How do you want me to handle this at the group? What do you want me to say? Right. And I ask them that ahead of time, because I know that I'm going to have to answer the answer those questions. Now, if they're coming back into AA and they're not going into a treatment or a detox and they're coming back to the home group, we have that conversation right up front, because it says avoid answering these inquiries as much as you can whenever possible. Let the alcoholic explain. Right. And so I prepare them for that. Listen, on Monday morning, we're going to be at the home group. So how are you going to handle this? How would you like me to support you in this? Are you going to announce? Are you going to take a white chip? How are you going to do this? And so communication and consultation, I think, goes a long way in supporting. Top of page 116. Oh, wait, we already did that. Top of page 118. Oh, I really like this. This is for the husband and the wife who are both trying to practice these spiritual principles, right? And the home is in turmoil. The husband is recovering from alcoholism, and that's not easy. And it's saying, when these heated discussions come up, and I love this quote, I have it underlined, I have it highlighted. This is getting serious. I'm sorry I got disturbed. Let's talk about it later. Oh, what a wonderful script, right? To have memorized, to read word for word. I would love to tell you guys that I'm the one who can apply this in my house. Well, my husband doesn't do a very good job right now applying this, but he has been the one in the past to be able to apply this so well with me. And I'll tell you, I'm a fix it now type of girl. And when he just says, I need space, and, you know, takes his keys and tries to leave or whatever, right? Or locks himself in the bedroom, I'm knocking on the door and I'm trying to take his keys. But when he can communicate, and that doesn't happen anymore, he does normally communicate, you know, when he actually says, you know, this is getting serious, I'm sorry I got disturbed, let's talk about it later. It really does calm me down a little bit, knowing, okay, we're going to pick it up. He just said that we're still going to talk about it. Right. And so this is a really good script, to use, depending on which role you play at your household. So the next paragraph down, my highlight is patience, tolerance, understanding, and love. What amazing words to live by. These are the watchwords. Show him these things in yourself, and they will be reflected back to you from him. Live and let live is the rule. And you know those platitudes on the wall that we see, live and let live, those the signs, they come from these two chapters. They're not talking to the alcoholic. They're talking about the family afterward and the wives, and how to deal with the alcoholic, right? First things first, none of that stuff is ever in our literature applied to the it's always applying to something other than to the alcoholic. I've just noticed that, not just now, but I have noticed that. At the bottom of the page, about four or five lines up, we do not like the thought that the contents of a book or the work with another alcoholic has accomplished in a few weeks, that which we have struggled for years. Can you imagine a wife who has tried to help her husband to get sober for years, hiding the bottles, nursing his hangovers, and then all of a sudden he goes to AA, and in a few weeks, he's getting better? I mean, talk about powerlessness, right? And this can be reconciled with Appendix 1 in the back of the book, right? The spiritual experience. I love to go to this page because There's so few places, appendix two, sorry. There's so few places in the book that tells a time frame of how long the step should take. In this one, my highlight about three lines up from the bottom of the page on appendix two, for page one of appendix two, what often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline, right? Because human power, I mean, God can do what we can't do. So that's a good reconciliation. Page 119, still another difficulty is that you may become jealous of the attention he bestows to other people, especially alcoholics, right? Like once he starts working with others, once he gets on his 12th step, man, you have been starving for his companionship, yet he spends long hours helping other men and their families. You feel he should now be yours. The fact that he should work with other people. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is a huge highlight. Let me read it right. The fact is that he should work with other people to maintain, circle that, right? The maintenance of our spiritual condition, to maintain his own sobriety. And there's a theme in this book. I don't know if you guys have picked it up yet, but in every single chapter, the theme is you got to give it away to keep it. You got to give it away to keep it. You got to give it away to keep it. You got to give it away to keep it. And it says it in 103 different ways for the first 103 pages that are our 12 steps. So on page 120, I appreciate this part. It's one, two, three, four paragraphs down. We never, never try to arrange a life's book. It says it twice. We never, never try to arrange a man's life so as to shield him from temptation. We know that that can be reconciled with page 101, with page 147. That is all over our book, that any scheme of combating the alcoholic temptation is doomed to failure, right? You can go put your husband on the Greenland ice caps, and even then, an Eskimo might show up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything, right? That's from page 101. So on page 120, right below that, later on down in the paragraph, if he gets drunk, don't blame yourself. I love this highlight. God has either removed your husband's liquor problem or he hasn't. It's as simple as that. He's either recovered or he's not. It's not kind of. The problem is either removed, 10th step promises, or you're still sick and suffering alcoholic with an alcoholic mind. So I love that. It's just that, you know, I don't get to beat myself up. The wife doesn't get to beat herself up. If not, if he hasn't removed the husband's liquor problem, it had better been found out right away, right? So that he can start, get back to work, get back on those steps. What have we skipped? Where is the mortar without sand? Where is the chunks in the foundation that we missed? Like, let's get back to work. Family afterward. And good. I think I'm good on time. First paragraph on family afterward that I want to talk about is on page 125, right smack dab in the middle of the page. It says another principle, because this is all about principles that we can be observing in all of our affairs, right? Another principle we observe carefully is that we do not relate intimate experiences of another person unless we're sure he would approve. Now, this can definitely be applied to sponsorship. I was really nervous about sponsoring when I first started sponsoring. Very nervous because I'm a big mouth. I love to gossip. There's no bigger character defect that I have than to call somebody up and go, "Oh my God, you'll never guess what I just heard." Like that is my thing, right? And there's nobody more, I mean, nobody more surprised and shocked that out of hundreds of fifth steps that I've heard, I have not even not shared with somebody else about something in a fifth step. I've never even been tempted to. And that is a God thing. That is not me, because that's not the way I am with my friends. My sponsees and my friends, two entirely different things, unfortunately, you know, but one of the things that I do do is I will share things. Like Stephanie's in the room, I see her now. She has a lot of experiences that I can pass on because she has experiences that I don't have, right? There's a couple that I use quite often. She's the Stephanie that you guys have heard me talk about in Tradition 10, in my Tradition 10 talks, that accidentally posted something pretty neutral, but you could kind of tell which way it was going on Facebook, right? And her responsey, blah, blah, blah. That's her experience, but she's okay. That didn't happen during a fifth step, right? She's okay if I pass that on. She's okay that I use those experiences. So I have to make sure he would approve, right? That's my highlight. Make sure he would approve. So I usually ask my sponsees before I share any intimate. I don't know if I share anything intimate, but I usually will ask my sponsees or at least know them well enough to know that I can pass on something that that happened to them. But I also try to not make a habit out of sharing someone else's experience as my share. I mean, if I'm in a workshop or, you know, big book study or something like that, but it's really uncomfortable. I got this guy in my home group and he really likes to share other people's experiences as his whole share. And so for me, if it applies to my share and if it applies to me and if it applies to my 12-step work and my sponsee or someone who's, you know, my sponsor, or my sponsee or my 12-step work or whatever, it's a little bit more appropriate than to just say, oh yeah, you know, that reminds me of a share that I heard and then just share somebody else's share and then end your share. I don't know if that is what this is talking about, that would be appropriate. I try to stick to my own experience, strength, and hope the best I can. On page 129, and actually, you know what? I think I want to read. I think I have enough time. I want to read this whole, because this whole, it's so hard to skip any of this. So on the top of page 128, giving rather than getting will become the guiding principle. Circle that word, the, because this could have very easily said giving rather than getting will become a guiding principle. This is the guiding principle, right? If I want, I got to give it away to keep it. That's what this thing is. A kindly act once in a while won't fit the bill. We must play the good Samaritan every day, is what this stuff says. Assume, on the other hand, that Father has, on the outset, a stirring spiritual experience. Now, you guys, when I'm laughing, and you guys are laughing, we're laughing at ourselves, at least if you're like me, because I've been here and I've done that. I've done this. Overnight, as it were, he is a different man. He becomes a religious enthusiasm. For me, it wasn't a religion, but it was an AA enthusiast, right? He is unable to focus on anything else. As soon as his sobriety begins to be taken as a matter of course, the family may look at their strange new dad with apprehension and then with irritation. There is talk about spiritual matters morning, noon, and night. He may demand that the family find God in a hurry or exhibit amazing indifferences to them. And he may say it's above worldly considerations. He may tell mother, who has been religious all of her life, that she doesn't know what it's all about and that she had better get his brand of spirituality while there's yet time. When Father takes this tact, the family may react unfavorably, if you could imagine. They may be jealous of a God who has stolen dad's affections. While grateful that he drinks no more, they may not like the idea that God has accomplished the miracle where they failed, right? And that's a theme in these two chapters as well. They often forget Father was beyond human aid. They may not see why their love and devotion didn't straighten him out. Dad is not so spiritual after all, they say. If he means to right his past wrongs, why all this concern for everyone in the world but his family? What about his talk that God will take care of them? They suspect Father is a bit balmy. He is not so unbalanced as they might think. Many of us have experienced Dad's elation. I know I have. Many have indulged in spiritual intoxicants. Oh, it's so hard to even say these words because of the feeling of guilt and, you know, identification. Like a gaunt prospector, belt drawn in over the last ounce of food, our pick struck gold. Now, this is a part that this is one of my favorite parts in the whole book, actually. Joy at our release from a lifetime of frustration knew no bounds. Father feels that he has struck something better than gold. I love this part. For a time, he may try to hug the new treasure to himself. He may not see it at once that he has barely scratched a limitless load, which will pay dividends only if he mines it for the rest of his life and insists, look that word up, on giving away the entire product. The entire product. Got to give it away to keep it. That's the theme, right? 100 different ways. Got to give it away to keep it. 100 different ways of saying it. Okay. So we're going to go to the happy pages. It's what Dave W. used to call it in my home group. Page 132. We've been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We've been dealing with alcohol and its worst aspects, but we aren't a glum lot. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. We try not to indulge in cynicism over the state of the nation, nor do we carry the world's troubles on our shoulders. When we see a man sinking into the mire that is alcoholism, we give him first aid and place what we have at his disposal. For his sake, we do recount and almost relive the horrors of our past. But those of us who have tried to shoulder the entire burden and trouble of others find we are soon overcome by them. Now, this one paragraph that I just read has so much information and so many instructions and directions. Okay. So first of all, it tells us that an AA meeting ought to be a pep rally, right? It shouldn't be stupid, boring, and glum. It shouldn't be, oh my gosh, I can't believe my life. I stepped in dog shit on my way to the Chevron to buy my Marlboros today and the luck I have. And then the next person shares, and then they're going to one up them. And then you hear about the guy whose grandma just died yesterday. And then they say, hey, if you want what we have, and the newcomer's going, no, wait, no, what you got, you know? And that's one way to chase somebody out of a meeting. But if they show up and they see these people laughing and fellowshipping and loving each other and caring about each other's lives. I mean, this is a program of attraction, right? Let's make it attractive. Every AA meeting should be a pep rally. And then it tells us, and I've heard a whole bunch of people, oh, we don't do drunkalogs. Nobody wants to hear a drunkalog. It says the exact opposite here. The exact opposite. It says, for his sake, we do recount and almost relive the horrors of our past. Without a drunkalogue, there's no identification. And without identification, there's no recovery and no solution. And so a third of my story has to be what I was like. Then I can get to what happened as the result of the steps and what I'm like today. But without that identification, without reliving and sharing the horrors of what I was like, then there's no identification. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience out of the past. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and have been given the power to help others. I didn't come here for that. I came here to try and learn how to stop puking on my shoes. I have never had the power to help anybody in my life. Why shouldn't we laugh? I've not only recovered from alcoholism and the problem has been removed, but I've been given the greatest gift, the power to help others to recover from alcoholism. Hell yeah, it's a pep rally. It is a pep rally. And sometimes people don't like to see you happy in AA. And my friend Davey, he's our GSR of my home group. He said it for a few months when I first started getting to know him. And the more I think about it, the more it's true. He says, if you want to try and piss off a bunch of the meeting makers in AA, just be happy. And at first I'm like, what a terrible thing to say, right? But it's my experience, unfortunately. And I can't help it. I'm not trying to piss nobody off. I'm just happy because God has restored me to sanity and the problem has been removed. And oh my God, why shouldn't we be happy? We have the power to help others. Like, there's nothing in the world that I would rather do than help another drunk today. One of the, this is at the bottom of page 133. One of the many doctors who had the opportunity of reading this book, in manuscript form, told us that the use of sweets was often helpful, of course, depending on a doctor's advice. He thought all, and I love how this book and this chapter always go back to, of course, depending on a doctor's advice, right? It never tells us to play doctor. It always says consult a doctor. He thought all alcoholics should constantly have chocolate available for their quick energy value at times of fatigue. He added that occasionally in the night, a vague craving aroused, which would be satisfied by candy. Many of us have noticed a tendency to eat sweets and have found this practice beneficial. You know what? I'm just gonna, this is, I gotta tell you, my home group, we have a budget for our we have a budget, a quarterly budget, I think it is now. I think it moved from monthly to quarterly, but we have a budget for our supply chair. And the supply chair has a certain amount of money to spend on coffee and cups and snacks. And I'm not saying I'm right and he's wrong, or he's right and I'm wrong, or whatever, right? But all of a sudden, there was a lot of money being spent on healthy snacks. Now, I can eat a box of donuts, no problem. And I shouldn't be, right? And I try really hard not to. And so when people bring in a box of donuts, it's really difficult for me, and I try to avoid looking at it, But when the supply guy started bringing in healthy snacks, I mean, for a second, my selfishness and self-centeredness went, "Oh, this is great." And then I started thinking, "Wait a minute. I can buy my own lunch. Like, that's not what this is about, We buy chocolate for the detoxing newcomer. That's what this is about." And this is another way of Tradition 12, right? Reminding me that I have to sacrifice personal ambition for the common good, right? I got to be thinking about you, not me. And the newcomer, and the fact that they might need some chocolate, even though I'll eat the chocolate and I don't need it. But that's my own issue. That's my own outside issue. I can take that up outside, right, with my sponsor. But the newcomer shouldn't have to go without the treats just because I want to be healthy. So, another experience that I can share is when I first got sober, my first sponsor's name was Anna, and I definitely liked the chocolate. I would go to the Redmond Rebels meeting every Monday in Redmond, a whole nother town, just because they had a big old chocolate sheet cake with mousse filling every Monday. And that's that. I mean, I was willing to drive there just for that. And I gained, I think it was like 15 pounds in a matter of 3 weeks in my early sobriety because I was just putting down the chocolate. And I got really, emotional about it when I got out of the doctors and I saw how much I had get, you know, I had realized how much weight I was putting on, and I ended up at my sponsor's house crying. And I look back and I think maybe her and Scott, her husband, were having an intimate, I think I maybe interrupted something. So I'm not wholeheartedly convinced that she was just short with me because of my complaining and what the topic was that I was at her doorstep about. But I was crying and I was like, oh my God, I've gained 3 pounds. I got to go on a diet and I got to stop eating chocolate and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, you're newly sober. Would you rather be fat or drunk? And she slammed the door in my face. And I'm like, well, I never, right? And what she was doing, I mean, ideally, that's the type of sponsorship she, my first sponsor was very direct. And she had no problem telling me what to do. That's not the way I sponsor, but looking back, it's probably the way I needed to be sponsored for me, for this alcoholic. And looking back, you know, she eventually told me, look, you can go on a diet. You can get this weight thing under control after you get the alcohol under control. Don't worry about that right now, right? And the principles are described so perfectly on this next page of her working with me, because she was, in this case, I'm the alcoholic, and she was the one working with the alcoholic, and she's using these principles of first things first, live and let live, and easy does it with me. So let's read where that those lines come from. This story is amazing. So whether the family goes on a spiritual basis or not, the alcoholic member has to if he would recover. This is on page 135. The others must be convinced of his new status beyond the shadow of a doubt. Seeing is believing to most family members who have lived with a drinker. Now, here we go. Ready for this? Buckle up. Here's the case in point. One of our friends is a heavy smoker and coffee drinker. There was no doubt he overindulged. Seeing this, meaning to be helpful, his wife commenced to admonish him about it. He admitted that he was overdoing these things, but frankly said that he was not ready to stop. His wife is one of those persons who really feels there's something rather sinful about these commodities. So she nagged, and her intolerance finally threw him into a fit of anger, and he got drunk. Her fault. No, it's just so funny the way this is written. Okay, so of course our friend was wrong, dead wrong, right? It's not her fault. He had to painfully admit and mend his spiritual fences, though he is now a most effective member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He still smokes and drinks coffee, but neither his wife nor anyone else stands in judgment. She sees that she was wrong to make a burning issue out of such a matter when his more serious ailments were being rapidly cured. We have three little mottos which are appropriate. Here they are. First things first, live and let live, and easy does it. And those are mottos that we have to, that I get to employ and get to observe when I'm working with others. It can't be all about right now, right? It can't, they are not going to be fixed overnight. And in fact, you know, I get a newcomer who's really trying to stop drinking and dying of alcoholism. And the first thing that they tell me is, oh my God, I got to quit smoking, or I got to quit, you know, doing this, or I got to quit doing that. And I'm like, no, not in your first year. In fact, if you don't smoke, that's probably something good to pick up in your first year. Not that I really say that, in all honesty, I don't really say that, but I think it, Because that'll help you fellowship outside the meeting with the other newcomers, right? That is going to get you involved. But no, don't try to quit smoking in your first year. Don't try to quit drinking coffee in your first year. And I shouldn't say your first year because I'm being a hypocrite here. I never use the time to describe, but in your first set of steps, right? Through steps 1 through step 12, while you're still recovering from alcoholism, let's focus on that, right? First things first. Easy does it. So with that, I'm done.
All audio and video files on the District6AA.org website or the District 6 in Area 15 YouTube channel are for personal use only. Reproduction, distribution, and commercial use are not permitted. In accordance with District 6 current practice, no faces are shown in our videos and audio is scrubbed for anonymity prior to publishing. Contributors whose voices are heard have given record and release consent. Opinions expressed by the presenter are their own and do not necessarily represent the group conscience of District 6 as a whole.